This time last year, an article on gym class in The Atlantic caused quite the uproar in the PE community and beyond. It was based on a study indicating that PE doesn't have a positive impact on health, on academic performance. Gym class can even have negative repercussions like truancy because kids hate it so much. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and today we are revisiting a conversation about PE from when that article came out. What is PE trying to teach, and in a perfect world, what would gym class look like? Our first guest is Aaliyah Wong, who wrote the article. Hi, Aaliyah.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Talk to me about the response to your article.
Well, I've never gotten such intense response from people who loved PE, people who are PE teachers. Definitely a lot of PE haters. A lot of people, I may have triggered them into remembering back to their PE days, their stinky clothes, their mean teachers, their failure to run around the track, etc. It's been an outpouring for sure.
So dig in a little bit more and tell me about, we'll start with the negative responses and then we'll move to the sort of like defense of PE kind of responses.
Sure. So the negative responses kind of ran the gamut from just really sad stories about feeling bullied by their teachers, people who were convinced they weren't athletically competent, that they could never, ever manage to run in their lives or play a game, and maybe later in life found some activity that made them realize that, hey, I actually am good at sports. It just wasn't the kind of sports I was doing in PE. I heard stories of people who somehow found a way to get out of it. One person wrote me saying that she pretended to have a bee sting and had her friend rub holly leaves over her arm so that it would look like she actually did have a sting. I've heard people who said they just watched a lot of movies in gym class. And I've heard stories of people who, you know, were bullied by their peers because maybe they were overweight or just somehow awkward.
You know, you write a lot of articles in a national magazine. Is the volume of response and the like personal nature of it unusual?
I'd say it's definitely unusual. There have been a few pieces in the past that did generate this kind of response, although much different themes. But I think what did really strike me is just how visceral everyone reacted to this. I think one takeaway I think we can all agree on is that PE is one of those experiences in school that really implants itself in our brains, that it's hard to forget. We got a response from
someone. Because we remember it in our bodies.
Yes, I think so, yes. I think it has that sort of, it really, you know, engages all the senses. It's like you say, it's obviously by definition a physical experience. You know,
social too.
It's social, and whether it was really good or really bad, it's really going to, I think, define your sense of self at that age and then through your later years.
Do you feel like you almost should be a therapist responding to some of these letters?
I feel like I have been tapped as a de facto therapist. I don't know if I should be since I'm not qualified, but the outpouring of messages and emails from my own coworkers, from my friends in our text chat group, from my relatives. It seems like they did seek out my support emotionally. And it's been a delightful experience. I by no means have any scientific or licensed ability to provide that therapy, but I'm happy to talk about it, obviously.
Well, recap the study for us. What exactly did it show, and what are sort of the limits of it?
Sure. So, yeah, and I think to start with the caveat is that it's very limited in scope because it was focused on one specific program in Texas. It was a $37 million grant program that was implemented in an attempt yes, to sort of improve the physical activity of children, but also boost their academic achievement and some of these other social-emotional outcomes that schools are trying to achieve. And it was a grant program, so it wasn't required, but schools that opted into it could get money for enhancing their PE programs, whether it was just buying more equipment, hiring more teachers, somehow expanding the curriculum. And one of the features of this is that it had to be a daily requirement, and it was for middle schoolers. And I think in that sense, it did have some unintended consequences. The fact that it was required daily, I think kids, especially middle schoolers, are just not going to respond well to something that they feel is forced on them every day. And I think particularly because it's middle school where bullying happens, you know, at a particularly high rate, kids are especially vulnerable. They're growing into their own skin, figuring themselves out. Since they're so vulnerable, and PE can be an experience that forces kids into situations that involve bullying, whether it's because they're overweight and can't, you know, run around the track, or if they're in the locker room and maybe, you know, aren't fully developed. There's just a whole range of scenarios that could expose them to bullying, and then it's
a landmine for a middle schooler.
And it can be a perfect storm for some of these things we're trying to avoid. That's why I think the outcome of the study wasn't only that it had little or no impact on sort of the core goals of physical improvement and academic improvement, but it also maybe compelled kids to just skip school rather than have to go to this class or to act out. And that's why they also saw increases in discipline problems.
So we've heard a lot about why people don't like gym when they look back on it, why what this study reveals that is maybe discouraging for gym teachers today. So talk to me about what the PE lovers have reached out to say to you.
I mean, I really, really value those responses in general. I appreciate criticism as long as it's thoughtful and diplomatic. And I think it was a lot of PE teachers are really part of what I think of as this new generation of PE educators who are trying to sort of disrupt that stereotype of, you know, the tyrannical, cold and probably very harsh PE teacher who's just, you know, has a whistle around his neck and is yelling at you to run faster. I think these educators realize that PE is very much about social emotional improvement, whether that's meditation, constant movement to get out what one teacher told me, the sillies, which I thought was a cool way of thinking about it. You know, kids have a lot of energy, and especially in this day and age, they have attention issues. So PE can really serve to sort of ameliorate some of those problems. And they're realizing that empathy is a really key part of their job and are really trying to display that. And so there are
Different threads within the PE community.
Yeah. And so I think and there's this also this school of thought that it's related is that PE shouldn't just be this kind of standalone course where you jump rope and do some burpees or whatever. It's that it should be something that's integrated throughout the school curriculum, and it should, you know, consider recess a part of the program. It should consider maybe, you know, a morning, a lot of schools will do morning movement sessions, you know, just some yoga-like activities just to get the blood flowing and get them ready to start the day.
Well, I'm interested in your takeaway, not just from the study, but from the avalanche of feedback you've gotten.
Yeah, so, I mean, one takeaway, obviously, is that PE deserves more coverage. It deserves nuanced coverage. I really tried to make my story nuanced. I think a lot of people may have just seen the headline and reacted to that, which is common in this day and age on Twitter. But I think PE is something that really, really affected a lot of people in different ways. So I think there's definitely more to delve into. I'm hoping that there's more research on it. I'm looking like I'm going to go to the PE Institute this year, which is an annual event that convenes PE teachers from all over the country, and they meet, and I guess just, you know, it's like a professional development workshop. So I might attend that, and I'm hoping to get some stories out of there. I think bullying is a topic that, you know, it has been covered a lot, but it's clear that there's more to do on that front. So definitely a lot of follow-up stories to be done. Maybe I'll just write about PE and that's it from now on.
Your new beat.
My new beat.
I want to bring in some PE teachers. We have two gym teachers in the room. They're both trying to be really creative in how they approach PE. Nick Williamson teaches elementary school PE classes at Crossroads Academy Quality Hill. Hi, Nick.
Hi.
And we are also joined by Stephanie Dixon. She's an instructional coach for PE at all the KCK public schools, which means she is teaching the PE teachers and guiding overall philosophy. Hi, Stephanie.
Hello, good morning.
So, Stephanie, I'm going to start with you. What is the purpose of PE? What is it trying to instill? Just your own personal answer to that.
I think I've been in teaching for 21 years, and in that 21 years, it has drastically changed. To be more, like Aaliyah said, more personalized fitness, student voice, student choice. We need to create kids that want to be physically active for a lifetime, not just K through 12. So we're trying to instill as physical education teachers those healthy habits, healthy lifestyles, nutrition, that physical component, that physical activity is important.
What gets in the way of those efforts?
Resources. I think this article just kind of polarized the physical education community in a good way, because when you put money towards something, that doesn't mean that you're just going to get certain outcomes. I really wanted to, you know, see about the mission, the outcomes. What was the purpose of the grant besides just giving them money? And so I think it's really important that resources get in the way, facilities. We have a lot of buildings in our school district that are very old. And so some gyms are over 50 years old. And so our facilities get in the way also.
And so you're also saying that it's been changing in the 21 years you've been in this field. How is PE changing?
Even when I was in fourth grade, I remember the balls that we played in dodgeball, and they were plastic, and they had Tachikar written across them, and they were like literally embedded in my forehead, and I broke so many pairs of glasses. And so I look back on that, you know, 44 years ago, and now looking what we're doing now, we have yoga, we have mindfulness, we have personalized fitness plans, we have very specific needs for our kids, because I think intrinsically we all want to be healthy. And so as physical education teachers, we need to arm those kids with lifestyle changes, how they can go home and help mom and dad go to the grocery store and shop. Or, hey, we have a couple minutes in between a TV show. Let's do some burpees, or let's do
what
some
What are burpees?
Civics.
Like, this is the second
it's
time
kind of
they
like
come
a mountain
up.
Climber. I'll show you after the show.
Okay.
But they're kind
this
of
is a new term for me.
Just anything to get, you know, 2 to 3 minutes here and there sporadically throughout the day to increase your physical activity levels.
So you're seeing PE not just as like, I don't know, there used to be this idea, I feel like, just in my experience, like of sort of survival of the fittest, almost like,
right.
Like it was almost like a gladiators or something in PE. Well, you know what I mean? And like now it just sounds like what you're talking about is educating people to be physical entities in the world and to take care of themselves and their bodies. That's not what I feel like PE used to be.
No, and it's not. And I mean, still there are facets. I think that's why this article was so awesome in many ways. The headline was crazy, but that, you know, once
headlines are always crazy.
Hey,
not my fault.
It got my attention.
Yes.
So, I mean, you know, and so I think just having that, it has totally changed. And we do have facets of, just like in any teaching field, in any field that you go into, there are certain teachers that still roll out the ball. you have to get, you know, time a mile, and if you don't get it, you flunk the PE class. There are certain people that are still out there. And I think the people that are on social media and on Twitter and all those other things are really trying to increase awareness for teachers, for parents, for community members, just society as a, you know, as a whole segment, that we have to help.
Well, Nick, you teach PE in the kindergarten to fifth grade age range, little kids. What are your goals for kids at that age?
So really the main things that I focus on are I want them to be excited to walk into the gym. And the other thing is I want to teach them how to solve problems. And so we talked a little bit about how it's such a social experience, and I really don't think that there's any better place than the gym to really focus on real life social problem solving. And so my goal is to get them to love moving and to solve problems.
So how do you do that? Give me some examples of like ways that you go about teaching those are important skills.
So to get them to love moving, it starts with just making sure that they feel safe and comfortable in the gym, making them feel like they can take a risk. Most of the things that they're going to try in the gym, they're probably going to fail the first, you know, 5, 10, 20 times. And so if everybody comes in knowing I'm probably not going to be successful, and that's going to be the same for everybody, and it's going to be okay.
So setting the expectations in a different way.
Correct.
So you don't do like the... There was like a tone of voice that I would associate with gym teachers that is not like, if you fail, that's okay, is not the message in the tone of voice I'm recalling. It's like, come on, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah, I think that there used to be kind of the stereotype is the old school PE teacher is more of like a drill sergeant.
Yeah.
Giving totally. You, you know, derogatory nicknames and, you know, punishing you by making you run laps or do push-ups, like that's going to make you enjoy physical activity more. And
yeah, by seeing it as a punishment.
Yeah.
Well, so I'm curious about your own experience with PE as a kid and what's inspired you to get into this field.
So I had the same PE teacher from first through eighth grade, and I really enjoyed it. I didn't grow up playing sports. I tried out for basketball in eighth grade. I was on the B team, and I was that kid that could never make a basket. I was lucky if I would shoot a ball and it hit the net. And so if you would have told me in high school that I'd graduate college with a degree to teach PE, I probably would have laughed. And I just ended up making some friends in college that kind of pointed me in that direction, and turned out that's what I was good at.
Do you think that you're, that the fact that you're not coming from this like overachiever in PE kind of background helps you connect with a certain kind of student, a kind of student who maybe is exactly the kind of person reaching out to Aaliyah being like, I hated gym.
Yeah, absolutely. I always consider myself, you know, one of those kids that was just uncoached. I had no idea how to do things. When I joined basketball team in eighth grade on the B team, I had no idea how to dribble or shoot baskets. You know, and my dad went to the video store and picked up a Michael Jordan highlight reel. That wasn't very helpful, but, you know, his mind was in the right place.
And you remember those things.
Absolutely, absolutely. So that's what led me to teach that way.
I'm Gina Kaufman. We're listening back to a conversation on the merits of PE. KCUR's Central Standard will be right back. Stay tuned. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. We're joined by two local PE teachers, Nick Williamson and Stephanie Dixon, who are trying to change PE. Hi, both of you.
Hi.
Hi.
We are also joined by Aaliyah Wong. She wrote an article that inspired this conversation. It came out in The Atlantic, and it seems to have vindicated kind of a widespread hatred of PE. It referenced a study in a limited setting, it should be said, that did not show a link between PE class and overall fitness, and maybe even had some unintended consequences with discipline in school. Aaliyah, welcome back.
Thank you.
What are your thoughts, having heard what Nick and Stephanie have to say? And then we'll turn to our callers.
Well, I was doing some burpees while they were talking. I also had to learn about them too, because I'm far from the fitness expert. But I really appreciated both of their comments. I think they encapsulate exactly the type of PE educator that I really admired and tried to highlight in the latter part of the piece. I think one of the PE teachers I interviewed for the article was really optimistic about what he perceives to be this revolution in how PE is taught and designed, and that we're going to see a real overhaul across the country. I think, you know, it probably many schools are still stuck in that kind of 90s, 80s, or 1980s drill sergeant. You know, someone described it as a pit bull looking like a mean, gruff man. That kind of stereotype is slowly fading away. I think, you know, the point about resources is really important, because resources can't just be spent superficially or without thought. I think one thing that is a pretty widespread concern is general investment in PE. We've seen a decline in the number of public dollars that go into PE as priorities shift to greater academics. But as both of them kind of alluded, PE, when really done best, is kind of woven into the school experience and seen as complementary to, rather than divorced from, the other coursework that kids are doing.
Let's talk to Sharon, who's called us from Blue Springs. Hi, Sharon.
Hello.
What's your story?
Well, when I was 9 years old in the fifth grade, I started my periods early and was held back from taking showers after gym class. And, oh, the girls made fun of it, that I was a teacher's pet, and why wasn't I taking a shower? And many of them had never even been told yet about what was coming and the periods and things.
Yeah, you know, and, this is something that you seem to remember with a lot of, like you remember it very clearly.
Oh, yes.
In a way that you probably don't remember the dynamics around, like, math class.
Right, because this did continue for years. Even after the girls found out about it, they just still kept picking on me.
You know, I want to talk to the gym teachers here about this idea that, you know, part of what people feel about PE has to do with PE itself. But then there's like this broader PE experience that doesn't necessarily have anything to do with your teaching. I mean, it's the locker room experience, for example. How do you manage that?
We have tried lots of different ways of doing things. I know that there's some districts across the state, well, across the United States, that have piloted programs where they don't dress out. And so they've had a whole gamut of different problems when they don't dress out. And then we have the other aspect that everybody has to dress out. Everybody has to look the same, in the same colored shorts, same colored shirt. And so that brings a whole different kind of set of problems. So maneuvering to the middle and finding that common ground of what makes these kids want to dress out besides a grade or participation. And then the safety issue, if you wear jeans that sag or belts or anything else that could get in the way.
Skirt that limits your mobility.
Of physical activity. So, I mean, I think it goes way beyond. And the article also said, you know, bullying really happens a lot in middle school, because that's when you go through the most changes, mm-hmm. Emotional, hormonal, everything. And so we kind of have to focus a little bit on how we can maneuver that in the best way from a social emotional point of view. And I think that's where physical education, Nick, we were preaching to the choir kind of thing, is I think we need to figure out what best practices look like, you know, in that area.
We have a call from Caitlin in Kansas City, who has thoughts about PE and what it should be. Hi, Caitlin.
Hi.
Tell me your thoughts.
When I listen to people talk about physical education, especially in a negative way, I do want to acknowledge that it has come a long way. Mm-hmm. As a PE teacher myself, you know, I've been through these trainings where we're really focusing on the academic portion of physical education. And I do find it frustrating when I hear people talk about PE, especially negatively, that they didn't have fun necessarily. And while it is a class where you're using your body and you need to learn how to play games and interact with others, it is still an academic class. So I wouldn't complain to my parents that I don't think math class is fun, because that's something that I have to do and learn to progress in life. And learning how to use your body, learning your foundational locomotor skills and how to move appropriately and effectively through life is just as valuable.
Can I just challenge you on that, though? Because later in life, I might continue to find math unfun, but I'm going to continue to be forced to do it, like when I'm figuring out a tip or when I'm doing taxes or all kinds of situations. I'm going to have to do math. Even hosting a talk show, believe it or not, I have to do a little bit of math because I have to hit time stamps in the show. So my question for you is, in a world where we are not forced to do physical activity, but it is very important that we have at least enough of a positive attitude toward it that we choose to do it, do you not think that having fun in gym class is maybe a responsibility of a PE teacher?
Well, I think that getting a student to enjoy whatever you're doing in an academic setting is important, because you want your students to be engaged and involved. But I would argue that what you're learning in physical education, especially at the elementary level where you're learning how to use your body, is something you're using for your whole life. You need to be able to run to catch a bus or to go up a flight of stairs appropriately. We're teaching kids how to throw a ball with their kids later in life. These are all foundational movements that, while you might not go on to be an NBA basketball player, you might not move on to be somebody that is super athletic or active in the gym, you still need to know how to effectively go through locomotor skills to carry yourself through life, even at the most foundational level.
Well, that I totally appreciate that point. I am curious about the role of fun in PE, and is that different than you would think it would be with other subject areas? I'm asking that of the PE teachers in the room.
I think it's easier to make the gym fun than it would be in the classroom. That's one of the easiest behavior things that I do, is kids don't like missing out on the fun, and so can't do that in math class.
And I think, you know, just bringing in music and just what the kids are doing outside and bringing it into the physical education setting is so important for them to start making those connections to the outside world.
What are your thoughts about, like, where gym is headed? We don't have a lot of time, but I am curious if this article in The Atlantic and hearing this outpouring of really, like, negative memories around gym. We do have positive memories. We have a tweet from someone who says that gym was her favorite part of the school day. It helped her get out pent-up energy. It helped her brain relax from academics. We all have another tweet saying our school in Lansing just started using things like dance and roller skating. Lots of positive things, but hearing all the sort of powerful negative memories around gym, does it make you think again about some things at all?
I think that always has to be in the back of your mind as any kind of educator, is how to elicit as many kids the engagement piece. Are we going to, you know, get all 100% kids all the time? No, but we have to reach at least 90%. We have to find what they're wanting, what they like, what they enjoy to do. And, you know, we have a fun little saying. We've kind of gotten rid of the fun in education because we're so focused on test scores and math scores and reading scores that we forget the most essential thing is to be healthy. Without health, you have nothing in your life. And so if we can start having little moments of time in school for kids to have fun, to be active, to be engaged, to be social, that's critical. That's critical for what we're doing.
Stephanie Dixon, thank you so much.
Thanks.
And Jim Williamson, also a local gym teacher, thank you.
You're welcome.
Aaliyah Wong, staff writer with The Atlantic, author of a very contentious article about PE, thank you for inspiring us.
Thank you. I'm glad it was inspiring.
When Central Standard returns, a conversation with the Wall Street Journal theater critic who hails from Missouri. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned.
I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and now I'm sitting here with Terry Teachout. If you happen to read the Wall Street Journal, that name probably sounds familiar. He writes the sightings column, and he also writes about plays, movies, museums. It is not a shabby gig, in my humble opinion.
It's the best job I know.
That was going to be my first question. Well, what you don't see in the byline is that the guy writing the column is from the boot heel of Missouri.
I am.
He went to college at William Jewell, and he cut his teeth writing music reviews for the Kansas City Star. We're going to hear that story now. Terry Teachout, good morning.
It's nice to be here. Thanks for having me.
And you look exactly like your illustration in that little square.
Well, I certainly hope so. It was taken in a radio studio.
So your job is as sweet as it sounds.
It is. I mean, there are nights when you're sitting on the aisle thinking, why am I here? Will this ever end? But then there are other nights when you're there and what you're seeing is Hamilton. And as far as I know, there's no downside to that.
What are some of the best plays you've gotten to see in New York specifically during your time doing this? And then we'll branch out.
Well, somebody asked me that, and I'll hook it up with Out of Town because they're related. The best show I have ever seen or reviewed anywhere in my life was David Cromer's off-Broadway production of Our Town. Which is one of the two great American plays. And Cromer is really the only American director whom I would not hesitate to call a genius. And this was a truly, profoundly revelatory production. I think 3 weeks before that, I was here in Kansas City because Kansas City Rep was doing David's production of The Glass Menagerie, which was maybe the second best thing I've ever seen anywhere in my life. Those two plays are very near and dear to my heart. In fact, I just wrote a play myself about Tennessee Williams and the making of The Glass Menagerie.
And a play within a play.
It was a play. It's a play about Williams and William Inge, who were, they met right around the time that The Glass Menagerie had its Chicago tryout. But I came, by this time, I knew who David Cromer was. He started his career in Chicago, and I review theater all over the United States. And I came out to Kansas City because it's Kansas City. It's part one of my homes. But I really wanted to see what he did with this very great play. And it was so great that it just, you know, scorched my eyes. And then 3 weeks later, I come to New York and he's doing Our Town and it's just as good. So that probably is the best reviewing month I ever had in my life.
What year was this?
It was exactly 10 years ago.
Wow.
2009, February 2009.
You know, your column sometimes does share bits and pieces of your own personal history. I was just reading your piece about The Green Book, where you get into some of the really important criticisms of that movie.
Yes.
But as part of that, you sort of casually mentioned that you saw one of the people in the story in real life perform on stage in Missouri.
In my hometown, Sykeston, 50 years ago. Don Shirley, who is the one of the two principal characters in the movie, He's the black pianist who does the tour of the Deep South, and the bouncer from the Copacabana is his chauffeur, and they become close friends. This was in 1969. The action in The Green Book took place, I think, 6 years before that. But Sykeston, where I come from, in the boot heel, is a town that its culture was like the Deep South. I'm 63. I am just old enough to remember separate entrances. And it happens that Don Shirley was the first black musician I ever saw in person on the stage of my junior high school gymnasium in Sykeston, Missouri in 1969. So I had this incredibly very specific memory of him. And suddenly they're making a movie about this guy whom I really haven't thought of for a number of years because he died in semi-obscurity, which he shouldn't have. And the movie has now led to a revival of interest in his music, which is quite well deserved.
Tell me more about the Sykeston you grew up in and how you think it shaped you.
Well, it is a small town. It's not a tiny town. It's the town where the people from all the really small towns come to do their shopping. And back then, you know, I was born in 1956. And the world was quite different then. You had three television networks, the CBS, ABC, and NBC, but they all had high culture programming as a routine part of their primetime activities. I watched the Ed Sullivan Show every Sunday night and saw, you know, Edward Fellella dancing ballet one week and the Beatles the next week. And this was all accessible to you. And as a result, network television was really my window on the larger world of culture. We had a community concert series. They were the ones who brought Don Shirley to town. My high school not only had a band and choirs, but it had an orchestra. I played violin in it. So to be in a small town like Sikeston in the 60s was a very different thing then. I was 3 hours from any large city. I didn't see a major museum until I was in college. But I had access to that larger world, and that was what opened the door and made me think, this art thing, maybe this is something I might want to do and be.
You wrote a memoir in the 90s called City Limits about your journey from Missouri to New York, and I get the sense that you wrote it in part to make sense for yourself of how you started where you did and ended up where you are. Is that fair?
Yes. I think this is why most people write autobiographies. They're trying to sort out their lives, and they may also feel that they have something to say to other people about the meaning of those lives. Louis Armstrong wrote his autobiography, Satchmo, My Life in New Orleans, because he thought that his life had a larger meaning and that it might help people know how to live. And in my case, I wrote this book because I was trying to figure out what happened. How did I get from there to here? It's a long way from a town like Sikeston to the Upper West Side of New York.
What did you figure out? I mean, do you have a sense of like what the crucial pivotal moments were that led you from there to here?
Well, I would say it was the larger arc. It was the decision to pursue the life of art. And in my case, it was a very unusual thing for a small town boy to end up becoming what I became and doing what I did. And it was because I realized fairly early on that I wanted to be immersed in art. I wanted this to be what I did all day. You spend at least a third of your life working and another third of it sleeping. And you really ought to try to do something for a living that doesn't bore you. And art doesn't bore me.
It seems like your time in college at William Jewell was pretty pivotal. You were there, you switched majors from psychology to a self-created major?
Yeah, well, psychology came later. I started out as a music major, and then Wesley Forbes, who was then the chairman of the music department, said to me one day, "You like music, you play music, you also write. Have you ever thought that maybe what you ought to do is write about music?" And this perfectly obvious thought had never occurred to me. So Dr. Forbes waved his magic wand, and suddenly I was doing an independent study with the man, John Haskins, who was then the music critic of the Kansas City Star. And that was in the spring. I went home over the summer, and he became ill, developed cancer. And when I came back that fall, he was dying, and I saw him a couple more times. And before he died, he told his assistant, who succeeded him, about me. And as a result, as an undergraduate, I became the Kansas City Star's second string classical music critic and their first string jazz critic.
What was that like for you? I mean, can you tell us what being a guy that young in the position of going to classical music concerts, writing about them, and having that published in the newspaper, what was that like?
You know, when you're that young, you take the world for granted. I mean, you assume that what is happening to you is normal, that everything is normal. It's only later that you realize this is really something unusual that happened to me back then. And so, I mean, I was delighted. I remember the day my first piece came out. I got up, I don't know, at 7 in the morning, and I drove down to the little strip mall. And it had, we used to call them honor boxes, the ones where you put a quarter in and got the newspaper out. I put a quarter in and got 10 copies of the Kansas City Star out. So I owe the Kansas City Star $4.
So much for honor.
Yeah, so much for honor. And I wrote a biography of H.L. Mencken, who had a sort of similar experience. He said that seeing his words in print for the first time was like receiving an electrical jolt of 1,000,000 volts while simultaneously drinking a barrel of brandy. And it was a little like that. You get used to that part, obviously. I mean, I've now been writing reviews for much more than half my life, but I will never forget what it felt to see my words in print for the first time.
So, I mean, this might actually be starting to sound like a much more linear story than we would start out thinking, because what led from there to here? Well, very early on, you were pursuing this thing. You were doing criticism very early in your education. But I am interested in, there's a period of your life where right out of school, you did flounder a bit.
Yes, I did. I couldn't make the transition to a full-time job. I had to pay the rent. I actually worked in an inner-city bank here in Kansas City as a teller. And it was very disorienting. It was very troubling. And I decided to go back to school. This is where the psychology came in. I had had a very opportune experience with a psychotherapist when I was an undergraduate. And I thought maybe I should do that. And I went back to school for 2 years as to get my undergraduate credits to become a therapist. During that time, I worked on the graveyard shift of a suicide line, which is really one of the most illuminating things about human nature and character that you can ever experience. I still remember, as though they were on a tape, some of the calls that I got. And what I realized, I mean, I realized a lot of things. And for me personally, the most important thing I realized was that I was kidding myself, that I was really a writer and that I was going to have to pursue that one way or another. And then I got lucky. I got an offer to be an intern at Harper's Magazine in New York. I was 29 years old, and it was like I had a key, and I finally found the right keyhole to put it in. I turned the key and walked into the rest of my life.
So if I've done the math right, you've actually lived away from Missouri longer than you lived in it. Does New York feel like your home now?
No. It felt like my home after 9/11. It happened on 9/11. I just finished a book and delivered it, and I went home to visit my mother. So I actually watched the news about 9/11 from the TV in the living room of the house where I grew up. And you will remember that every airplane in the United States was grounded that day, and I couldn't get back to New York. And I think for the first time in my life, I thought, my home is on fire. I have to get back.
I need to be there with my people.
And the first day that we were flying, I flew back and we did the approach to LaGuardia that loops around the southern end of the island. And I saw the smoke rising from ground zero. And at that time, and for a few years after that, I did feel that sense of home about New York. It's worn off, I think, because I am not in any way alienated from my childhood. I loved where I grew up. I loved Kansas City. I thought I would live here. And coming back here, you know, for a couple of days, I was just telling a friend of mine a few minutes ago, I feel like Emily in the last act of Our Town. I know where everything is, but when I talk, nobody can hear me. I reach out and I'm a ghost. But the city is still the same. And I think to myself, I love this place too.
What is it about New York that doesn't quite become home to you?
That's hard to say. Let me come at that in a different direction. The part of New York that seems like home to me is the people I love. New York is a city full of people who have come there for a reason.
To be the best at something.
Yeah, the New Yorkiest people I know are all from Council Bluffs, Iowa. And you seek them out, the people who have the same obsessions that you do and have the same interests that you do. And you start to think of your friends as a quasi-family. Everybody has this experience. And I have many close friends, and they are as important to me as they could possibly be. They're in New York, they're my home. In this town and in Sykeston, the place is my home.
Interesting. You know, how do you think that your roots here in your time in Kansas City have influenced the trajectory of the rest of your life?
Well, this is where I learned to write for openers. But I mean, it's where I first did a lot of things. I mean, this is where I, you know, first played in an orchestra, a real orchestra, you know, played at a jam session, talked on the radio. saw my words in print and got paid for it. I saw my words in print in high school, but nobody gave me any money for it. It's different when you actually get money.
And when the person reading it is not obligated.
Correct. Exactly right. This is the city where I learned what I was and what I had to do and be. And there are all sorts of things I like about Kansas City besides that. This is a city that has the right proportions.
What do you mean?
It's not too big. It's not too small. It has all the things that you want in it. It has a very serious and active art scene. It has one of the greatest museums in America, which I didn't realize when I lived here because I hadn't started looking at paintings. I collect them now, but back then, I think I went to the Nelson Atkins once when I lived in Kansas City. How ridiculous that is.
And now you consider it one of the best.
Well, there's everybody does. I mean, it's the Nelson Atkins now has, because of the new building, the Nelson Atkins now has the world reputation that it should have had 20 years ago. Because of the quality of the collection.
And this brings me to a question about the content of what you do. I mean, you've been doing this long enough that I'm sure you've witnessed all kinds of change in the arts itself and then also in arts criticism. What
Yes.
are some of the important things you've noticed?
Well, the change in the arts, I would say, this is especially true of theater, is that American regional theater has, the word I like to use is, it's become deprovincialized. I travel. I'm the only drama critic working for a national publication who travels regularly all over the country. And I learned very quickly that there was theater of the highest quality everywhere in the United States. When I started doing this, when I started reviewing out-of-town theater, you know, I thought it was praise to say, oh, this production's good enough for Broadway. Well, the truth is, you know, I see Broadway productions that are good enough for Chicago. And as I just said to you a few minutes ago, I mean, one of the two greatest shows I ever saw was here in Kansas City. So my whole perspective about that has changed because I now know that theater is an activity that people do on the highest level of seriousness and attainment throughout the country. It's not like it was 50 years ago when most of the serious theater in a town the size of Kansas City would be touring companies. No, it happens here. It's made here. And
it's interesting that you've come to that realization from your post doing theater criticism.
Well, there's no other way you could know it. It's a yeah. big country. And, you know, it's not like Time magazine is going out and reporting on theater in Chicago. It's because the Wall Street Journal decided it wanted me to cover theater all over the United States that I made this life-changing discovery. That's one side of the coin. The other side is that, as everybody knows, the traditional business model for newspapers has disintegrated. And all newspapers are cutting back. And the first thing they cut is arts coverage. I'm very lucky in that I write for a national newspaper and thus am able to be a drama critic and write every Friday.
And from a city with an identity so steeped in
correct.
In that practice.
Exactly right. So, I mean, I can sleep at night because I work for the Wall Street Journal, but I've seen it happen in newspapers all over the country. And it is a terrible thing for the arts. Virgil Thompson, another Kansas City boy, said very famously that whether you liked criticism or not, you had to remember that it was the only antidote that artists have to paid publicity. You discover that when suddenly you don't have a theater critic in Council Bluffs, Iowa anymore. And I think that a lot of people who, not without reason, think they hate critics, they're going to discover what it's like in a world that doesn't have them and also doesn't have arts coverage in newspapers. This will change as new business models for newspapers or successor organizations to newspapers emerge. But right now we're in a terrible state of turmoil. So those are the two things that are happening. Regional art's getting better. Regional coverage of art is getting worse simultaneously.
So we've established that you are very lucky to have a job and a secure one as a drama critic.
Boy, howdy, yes.
How do you balance enjoying the arts with writing about them? Because it is always a danger making something you love into your job.
Yes, it is. But I think specifically in theater, I didn't become a working drama critic until my late 40s. Most people come to it younger. And I think because of that, I never got jaded. I'm the least blasé person you're ever going to meet in this world. And I still get excited every time I come into a theater, wherever it is, and sit down on the aisle. And the lights go down, and I feel that sense of expectancy. It doesn't always last. You know, sometimes, usually it takes about 15 minutes to know what you're seeing. And when the clock hits that moment, you know it's going to be bad or it's going to be good. But if it's going to be good, I'm so excited.
And have you ever had a surprise turner, a comeback after that 15-minute mark?
A couple of times. It doesn't happen that often. But when it does, you know you're still paying attention.
Well, that's good.
Yes.
Well, Terry Teachout, drama critic for The Wall Street Journal, thank you so much for being here.
It's been a pleasure to talk to you.
Our conversation with Terry Teachout originally aired in February of 2019, and we brought it back out because we love it so much. You can listen back to either of this morning's conversations at kcur.org/centralstandard. That's also where you can sign up to have all our interviews sent right to you so you can listen at your own convenience, kind of like a podcast. kcur.org/centralstandard. Tomorrow, Laurel Hill Cemetery in Weston was one of the first cemeteries in Missouri to bury both black and white people. But a lot of the graves for black people were unmarked until recently. How a couple of passionate Missourians got names on those graves. Tomorrow at 10. Central Standard is produced by Melody Rowell, Mackenzie Martin, and Noah Taborda. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stick around for Up to Date.